Welcome, everyone. I'm Marilyn Stern, a Forum Fellow and serving as Chair. Today we'll be hearing from Dr. Jonathan Speier, a Middle East Forum Fellow and Director of the Rubin Center, formerly the Gloria Center, at the IDC in Herzliya. Our topic is the Saudi-Iranian proxy war currently playing out in Yemen. The Obama administration's policy of retreating from the Middle East has opened the door to Iranian ambitions to be the regional hegemon. There are many moving parts to the escalating crisis, and Dr. Speier will bring us up to date and brief us on the implications of Iranian expansionism in Yemen. Dr. Speier?
Thanks very much. Well, hello to everybody listening. And what I want to try and do in this short initial talk is to first of all give some background really on the conflict in Yemen, because it occurs to me that we're talking about immediate developments, but often not everybody's clear on kind of who the players are, where it all comes from. Then to look at what's happening right now and at possible prospects ahead. Well, with regard to the Houthis and the Houthi uprising, it's important to understand that this is not something which is new. It's been around since 2004, and it emerges from Sa'dah province in the north of Yemen and from the particular community, which is Zaidi Shias, who constitute about 41% of Yemen's population. And what happens is that, by the way, just worth noting that this was a group that dominated Yemen under the system of the Imamate up until 1962. So it's a group who were formerly dominant, who had very strong feelings of discrimination, and the Houthi uprising emerges from within that context. Hussein Badr al-Din al-Houthi, the Houthis, of course, are a family, was the first man to get this going in 2004. From the very outset, the government of Yemen accused him of being a pawn of Iran, which he certainly was, in the sense that the Houthis are aided by the Iranians. At the same time, genuinely coming out of a local situation, Hussein Badr al-Din al-Houthi killed in 2004. And the leadership of the Houthis passing then to his brother, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who remains in command of the movement up until today. Well, the subsequent decade, has seen a constant roiling uprising going through greater periods of intensity, periods of calm. We should note, given the current state of events, this is not the first time that Saudi Arabia has responded into Yemen against the Houthis. Obviously, the Houthi area, if we're looking at the map of Yemen, the Sa'dah province, is right up against the borders with Saudi Arabia. So there's tremendous potential for interference from the Iranians to use that as a kind of lever. And in November 2009, the Houthis killed a Saudi security officer on the border and took control of an area across the border into Saudi Arabia. The Saudis responded with airstrikes, moved troops to the border. I think around 300 Houthis just under were killed in the subsequent fighting and ended in a truce, but of course with no solution to the situation. The reason why things, of course, have become as acute as they have now dates back to 2011, to the taking down of the government of Ali Abdullah Saleh, or regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh, by agitation from below. And the Houthis were part of that. And the Houthis used the agitation against Saleh to extend their control, and this is important, to further areas of northern Yemen, in particular to Hajjah governorate. Why does that matter? Because by taking control of Hajjah, they got access to the sea, to the port of Midi on the Red Sea, from where they can bring in arms, where they can bring in supplies for themselves. Saleh, of course, resigns as a result of popular pressure, and is replaced by Abdurrabba Mansur al-Hadi as president, who nominally, of course, still remains the president. And what happens in the subsequent 3 years, largely away from media attention, is that the Houthis gradually extend their control through northern Yemen, down to Sana'a governorate, where the capital is, and around the city of Sana'a itself. And what happens in the latter part of 2014 is that the Houthis begin to kind of close the trap. That's to say, they hold demonstrations and protests nominally against increasing fuel prices in Sana'a itself beginning on August 18th. And by 21st September, they've seized control of Sana'a itself. They're clashing with Sunni militias supportive of the government inside the city. And of course, as we know, in January of this year, they attacked the presidential palace, they attacked the presidential residence, and Hadi resigns and is placed under house arrest. And it's on February 6th of this year that the Houthis dissolve parliament, declare themselves in full control of the country, establish a revolutionary committee, as they call it, to lead the country for the next 2 years, led by another member of the Houthi clan itself, Mohammed al-Houthi. Now, the current series of events begin with the escape of President Hadi from house arrest in late February. He escapes in Sana'a, goes down to Aden, declares it the provisional capital of Yemen, and fighting rapidly follows. It's important to note at this point that this is not simply a war between the Houthis and the president. The security forces themselves have split, some of them on the side of the Houthis now, some on the side with the president, and very importantly, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former dictator or former president, is now on the side of the Houthis. I say he and his supporters in the security structures fighting on the same side as the Houthis. The Houthis, as we know, begin to drive south at the end of March in the last month. People may remember the suicide bombing in Sana'a and four Houthi mosques, and that was the precipitator, so to speak, of the general mobilization declared by the Revolutionary Committee, which I mentioned a moment ago. They launched an offensive southwards. They claim that President Hadi is in league with al-Qaeda, and they're heading for Aden, which means they're heading, should they get all the way down to the south coast, for control of the strategically crucial Bab al-Mandeb Strait, which goes from Gulf of Aden through to the Red Sea, from which a massive number of, I think 4 million, is it, barrels of oil go through per week, a vital sea corridor up to the Suez Canal to bring petroleum products through. So it's at that point that the Saudis intervene, bombing from the air, of course, and announcing this Operation Decisive Storm, as they choose to call it, which is supposed to stop the Houthi advance and to rectify the situation. Of course, it has done nothing of the kind. Hadi has already left Aden, and he's now in Saudi Arabia itself. 9 days ago, the Saudis announced the ending of military operations, they declared victory, so to speak, in Operation Decisive Storm, and they said that the events would now shift from military operations to a political process. Of course, it's all very well to declare victory, but unfortunately the air campaign had not achieved what it was supposed to achieve, which is that it had not and has not halted the advance of the Houthis and their allies in a southward direction, which means that the declaration of the conclusion of Operation Decisive Storm was nothing more than an empty verbiage, because actually airstrikes have resumed almost immediately and are continuing up until now. And the Saudi National Guard units have been mobilized and are close to the border, and the Houthis are continuing to advance. Now, we're hearing just in the last couple of days that there is now fighting inside central Aden city itself, that the Houthis are advancing within the city, that people are being killed. And so there's no sense whatsoever that the Saudis have achieved their aim at this stage. Now, it's worth noting that there is already a massive humanitarian issue around all this. Around 300,000 people have been displaced so far by this conflict, around 12 million in a complete population of 28 million are short of food. So there is, in essence, what we've seen already in Syria over the last 4 years, what we're witnessing right now in Iraq has come to Yemen too, which is the effective collapse of another Arab, well, also in Libya, we should place to the list, the effective collapse of an Arab state into anarchy and into civil war. Now, the issue facing the Saudis right now is that the air campaign has failed, and if they want to stop the advance of the Houthis, they need to find a ground partner to fight them on the ground. And what appears to be happening is that the Saudis are electing to try to begin a process of training of tribesmen, of Yemeni tribesmen, Sunni tribesmen, who will act as that ground force. And we're starting to see some of those fighters already being introduced back into Yemen, and also the Saudis dropping supplies further north to where some of those fighters are engaged. With regard to the broader picture of Iranian interference, well, of course, we've seen in recent days the placing of the Iranian warships into the Gulf of Aden, and right now the latest news today is that there are two Iranian destroyers outside the entrance to Bavalmandap right now. An escalation is taking place, and we mentioned, we were discussing earlier before we came online, the bombing by the Saudis of the airport at Sana'a with the intention of preventing an Iranian plane from landing, supposedly carrying members of the Iranian Red Crescent. But of course, once again, looking at the experience of the region in the last 4 years, we recall the extent to which Iraqi airspace was used in order to, by the Iranians in order to bring weaponry to Bashar Assad, and it is likely that the direct air link from Iran to Sana'a is going to be used in a similar way, and so it's quite understandable that the Saudis are determined to disrupt, so to speak, that process. So that's pretty much where we are right now, in a very, very tense situation in which the Saudis are determined to prevent the falling of Yemen in its entirety into the hands of an Iranian proxy. And it's perhaps important to note right now that the evidence, because it's something which hasn't yet, I think, been sufficiently clear in media reporting, the evidence in support of the claim or the assertion that the Houthis are a client of the Iranians is enormous, and it's available, and people can find it, and it extends to ships which have been intercepted in the past. The Jihan 1, intercepted in January 2013, carrying weapons to the Houthis from the Iranians, and to clear evidence of training by the Iranians of Houthi fighters in Eritrea. That's the place where they used to train them, with the knowledge of the Eritrean authorities. So absolutely an Iranian client. The Saudis are determined to prevent another Arab state falling into the hands of the Iranians. I think we should place the Saudi assertion, assertiveness, which has taken place here, of course, with a broad coalition including four other Gulf countries, also Egypt and also Sudan. We should place this assertion in the broader context of the Saudi attempt to assemble a Sunni, or the new Saudi king, Salman's attempt to assemble a Sunni coalition to resist the Iranian advance across the region, absolutely in the context of the perceived abandonment of that task by the United States of America. That's certainly the way in which the Saudis see it, and that's why, very importantly, what's taking place right now is an attempt by the Saudis to rally the Sunnis across the region, Sunni powers including Turkey, including Qatar, including Egypt, to join that fight, so to speak, against the Iranians. Having said that, I think what we're also seeing in Yemen right now, and on this I'll move to my conclusion, is the extent to which, when it comes to fighting on the ground and mobilizing proxy ground forces, the Iranians are peerless. The Iranians have a level of ability which, so far at least, nobody on the Sunni side of the line has managed to equal. It's a fact that the Iranians in the Revolutionary Guards Corps possess an instrument whose precise purpose is the recruitment and raising of proxy political military forces. Hezbollah in Lebanon, of course, is the prototype of those. In the context of what we're seeing in the region right now, and in Yemen, but as we said, also in Syria, also in Iraq, namely the collapse of Arab states and the emergence of would-be successor forces, this is a tremendous skill to have. This is a tremendous instrument to have. And I think what we're seeing in Yemen right now is that once the air campaign is finished, the Sunnis, and in this case the Saudis, are a little bit lost, because when it comes to fighting on the ground, they don't really have anybody to immediately, or any ability to immediately raise a client in the way that the Iranians already have done. They've got their client, the Houthis, in place. Just lastly, I should, of course, mention before concluding the issue of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Of course, the Al-Qaeda branch or franchise in Yemen is generally regarded by analysts as being the most important and powerful franchise that Al-Qaeda core leadership possesses. I would say that we need to include maybe the Syrian Jabhat al-Nusra on that list too, but AQAP, very, very important player. Of course, the Houthis are trying to claim that Al-Qaeda, AQAP, is on the same side as President Hadi and fighting against them. It's not accurate. Al-Qaeda opposes both sides. Al-Qaeda has very strong presence and bases in the south and southeast of the country, and it's in the process of staging its own attacks out of those strongholds against both sides. So Al-Qaeda is there as a further complicating factor. To conclude then, what we have is, in a certain sense in Yemen, we have a meeting point of all the most kinetic and central forces in the region currently taking place, namely, firstly, the collapse of Arab states into non-governed spaces, secondly, the emergence of would-be successor entities usually organized on a sectarian basis, the Houthis, of course, on the one hand, these new tribal militias and Sunni forces on the other side, and then lastly, the attempt by both the Iranians on the one hand and the Saudis on the other, as part of the regional Cold War, regional sectarian Cold War taking place, to move in to support their own side, to prevent the other side from winning, and therefore, as a result, a massive amount of suffering for the people of those countries. And also, I would say, an ongoing instability, which in Yemen, as elsewhere in the region, is very, very far from being resolved anytime soon. We're in the middle of this conflict, and it's nowhere close to ending, and it's not yet clear what it will all look like when it is indeed concluded. So on that note, I'll finish these initial remarks, and I'll be very happy to take your questions or comments. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Speier. The question and answer period will now begin, and we invite your participation. Please note that when there are no questions in the queue, the moderator will ask a question. To join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to identify yourself when your line has been unmuted, please do so. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll take our first question now. And caller, if you wish to identify yourself, please do so when your line is unmuted.
My name is David Schimmel. It was an excellent presentation. Could you give us a sense of what are the military capacities of Saudi Arabia itself in terms of the sizes of its military, what kind of training they've gotten? We know they've spent untold billions of dollars over the last 50 years acquiring the most advanced kind of military technology from the United States, but I don't have the sense that there is anything more to them than just having expensive military toys. Is that a misperception?
I'm afraid that you have the, certainly in my estimation and the estimation of those I speak to who know the military side better than I, that is an accurate representation. That is to say, the Saudis certainly have spent a large amount of money on the most shiny new weapons systems. Everybody who I know who has worked with the Saudi armed forces on the ground is extremely critical of them and has the view of a very, very limited capacity on their part. And I think what we're seeing is that, you know, it's unlikely. We have the Saudi National Guard on the border, as been reported in the last 24 hours. But I think it's quite unlikely that we'll see a major incursion of Saudi ground forces. Yemen is very, very difficult territory to fight on. It's mountainous territory. It's dry. The Saudis have experience of getting into trouble on Yemeni soil back in the early 60s. They don't have the kind of tough and motivated ground fighters which the Iranians through the Houthis are able to put in the field. So I don't think they're even going to try it. I think they know their own limitations. They probably won't even try it. What they're going to try and do is they're going to try and mobilize tribal elements, and they've been training them, and they'll be supplying them, and these are the fighters they'll try to put into the field against the Houthis. These are men who know the ground and the area as well, in a similar sense maybe to the Iraqi tribesmen who the United States worked successfully with in the Sunni central Iraq in the 2006-2007 period. That's the kind of model of what they're about to try to do. And there's a fair chance that these guys will be able to, you know, will not be obliterated by the Houthis, which is why my sense is that what we're in for is a long and grinding fight. But I think that the Saudis will do everything to avoid committing their own men on the ground precisely because of the very, very acute, you really can't exaggerate, you know, the limitations of that ground force. It's untested. Everybody who works with it is highly unimpressed by it, and I doubt whether the Saudi official armed forces will be playing a major role in this. It's going to carry on being a proxy war on the ground, I would say. One caveat to that is to say there's already been reports of Saudi special forces inside Aden itself. Of course, when it comes to special operations forces, these are very, very highly trained and motivated fighters in small numbers. It's likely they'll be in there trying to stiffen the spine, so to speak, of the people fighting in Aden City. And just finally on this, well, you didn't ask it, but let me just complete the picture to say there are similar and parallel reports of the presence of Revolutionary Guards Iranian personnel on the ground with the Houthis.
If you don't mind my following up, I'm sorry, but does this tell us what things might look like if the Shias in the Saudi oil field areas are used in a similar fashion by Iran? The vulnerability of Saudi Arabia to withstand that if it were to follow the Yemen model?
Well, here's the thing with regard to that. The Saudis are quite good at putting down civilian uprisings. If we think of the one of the successes of Saudi arms in the last half decade, we remember that the Peninsula Shield Force, when it went into Bahrain in the early part of all this in March 2011, you know, performed adequately in putting down a civilian uprising or civilian protests. In the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, the Saudis, through their intelligence structures, have the thing very, very well locked down. That said, they're watching it very carefully for any signs whatsoever of the beginnings of paramilitary organization in that area. So if there is agitation in that area, I think it's most likely to take the form maybe of occasional bombings, but also of civilian protests. And when it comes to that, the Saudis are ruthless. And in that regard, I think they have a good chance of being successful. The Houthis is a different thing. You know, it's a group of people with a very strong military and paramilitary tradition, very well organized, going back already a decade and further. So it's not something which is that easy to replicate. I'm sure the Iranians would love to, but it's not something which is so simple to replicate in the very different context of Saudi Arabia itself, I would say.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll take our next question, our next caller. If you wish to identify yourself, please do so when you hear that your line has been unmuted.
Yes, thank you. This is Kenneth Bialkin calling. Thank you very much for your observations, which are critical. I'd like to ask you if you could relate what you just described and insert the United States into the equation with especially relation to the so-called framework with Iran and the progress that America seems to think it's going to make with Iran to come to an agreement which may bring Iran and the United States back into an atmosphere of friendship. Where does the United States end up there, opposed then to both Iran, maybe, in Yemen, and also opposed to Saudi Arabia in Yemen? And how does this affect our whole overall picture on the movement in the overall thing with Iran about getting them out of the nuclear business?
Yeah, first, thanks for the question. First of all, we need to note something of profound importance in this regard, which is the following. If the Iranians get the kind of deal which they clearly want on June 30th, it doesn't mean they necessarily will, but if they do, then what that will mean is it will mean an exponential increase in the Iranian capacity for interfering in other regional countries and in supporting their proxies. And that is because right now the Iranians are doing all that, but they are overstretched. They are committed in Yemen, they are committed in Iraq, they are committed in Syria, they are committed in Lebanon, and they are committed to support their friends in the Palestinian territories too. It's a lot for a country to do that's under some very real sanctions and restrictions. The figure which we're hearing is that should sanctions be rapidly lifted, as the Iranians are insisting they must be as part of any agreement, something like $50 billion would immediately or very rapidly come back on stream. And that would, of course, exponentially increase the Iranian capacity for interference. This is firstly. Secondly, with regard specifically to Yemen, it's interesting to note that, of course, the United States did flex its muscles. American sea power did flex its muscles in recent days to turn back Iranian ships supposedly heading to deliver arms to the Houthis. But at the same time, with regard to the politics, everything which I'm hearing is that Washington was not in favor of the decisive Saudi action in the air campaign, and that Washington was very pleased and indeed was pressing Saudi Arabia to declare the end of Decisive Storm on April 21st. That's to say, as far as America is concerned, nothing must be done to upset the Iranians at this crucial stage in the nuclear negotiations. Now, you're probably hearing from what I'm saying that I think there is a fundamental misperception at the root of that. And the fundamental misperception, which I believe is guiding U.S. policy right now with regard to Iran, is that the Iranians are amenable through carrots, so to speak, through temptations, through concessions, to being turned into a reasonable actor, and therefore nothing must be done to upset them. And the only the bare minimum must be done, even when one of their proxies is bearing down on an area as crucial to the region and the globe as the Bab al-Mandeb Straits. I think it's ill-conceived. What's happening is that the Iranians are interpreting these concessions, of course, as weakness, and it is causing them to double down yet harder. So if a deal is reached on June 30th and that results in the rapid lifting of sanctions, we're going to be seeing a whole lot more of this. I think the Saudis feel, and others in the region feel, that they're pretty much on their own in this regard, which explains the frenetic military and diplomatic activity of recent days and recent weeks. All this is happening precisely because of the sense that the United States is kind of absent on this, or at least is operating according to some fundamentally flawed assumptions, which are not going to lead anywhere good anytime soon.
You say this places the Saudis and the United States as adversaries with regard to Iran in
yes.
Yemen.
With regard to Yemen, ostensibly, United States and Saudi Arabia are on the same side because both of them are in favor of defending the legitimate and elected government of Abd Rabbo Mansour al-Hadi, the president. But the thing is that because of the broader context of the American desire for rapprochement with Iran, America is supporting a very minimalist approach to that support. As to say, the very minimum, and don't bomb if you don't have to, and let the Iranians have as much as you can possibly let them have. And this means that whilst ostensibly the Saudis and the U.S. are on the same side, they have a very different approach to how that interest should be furthered. The Saudis are worried about what the Iranians are doing and want to stop them. The Americans are, well, you know, the Iranians in lots of ways are our potential partners tomorrow, so we should do the minimum to upset them. It's a very different mindset.
Well, I'm not going to press it, but I think you're inconsistent in what you said, because it does place Iran and America on opposing sides.
Yes, sure, they are. In Yemen, well, let me reiterate. In Yemen, Iran and America are on opposing sides. The Iranians support
and therefore
the government.
And therefore, we are opposing the Saudis in Yemen.
Well, again, America and Saudi Arabia are supposedly on the same side in Yemen. Both are supporting the elected government, but the approach they are taking to that support is very, very different, and it is different because of the different ways those two countries look at Iran and its interests and its ambitions.
And where is Egypt?
Egypt is part of the coalition with Saudi Arabia. But Egypt has made very clear, Sisi has made very clear, that when it comes to the issue of committing ground forces, he's not keen to do so. Egyptian sea power will be committed in order to keep the Bab al-Mandeb Straits secure, because of course that's vital for Egypt too. When it comes to getting involved on the ground, you probably know the Egyptians too have a long memory, and in the 60s they got very badly bruised in a ground war in Yemen, and they have no great desire to repeat the experience.
Thank you, Mr. Bialkin. We're going to our next question. Bonnie?
Okay. So we'll go to our next question. If you wish, please introduce yourself when your line is unmuted.
Johanna Markind, thank you very much for your presentation. Given the prospect of losing to the Houthis in Yemen, what do you think is the prospect of the Saudis supporting al-Qaeda in Yemen?
Yeah, this is a good question. Look, I think that the Saudis will be immensely careful with regard to AQAP. Of course, the Saudis in the past have been responsible for supporting Salafi organizations in the region. But my sense is that because Yemen is so close to home, should they begin to start messing around with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you know, it would be suicidally foolish. And my sense is that this will not happen. My sense is that AQAP is going to be outside of this fight, basically certainly fighting against the Houthis, but also when it can, damaging the legitimate government in Aden as well. I don't think they'll be, at least at the current stage, I don't think they'll be anywhere close to trying to team up with AQAP. They have their clients, and their clients are the tribal forces. There are Sunni militias also which exist and are of long standing in Yemen. There is one called the Islah Party, which is the Yemeni franchise of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's an existing armed force on the ground. There's a thing called Popular Resistance Committee, I think it's called, which is backing President Hadi. So it's not that there are no armed Sunni elements on the ground. There are, and I think what will happen is that the Saudis will be trying to team up with them in the immediate period of time. When it comes to the issue of explosions and of weird stuff going on in Sana'a, and could there be an imaginable sense in which the Saudis are in contact with those jihadis who will be pulling that off, it's not unimaginable. But, you know, anything beyond that very, very murky sort of extreme, I don't think we'll be seeing a Saudi attempt to utilize the Salafis anytime soon. I think they'll be cautious, and rightly so.
Thank you.
Yes, Jonathan, to jump in and to support your point, when I was reading reports as to when the bombing was starting from the Saudis, that they were careful to target their strikes against the Houthis and to avoid targeting the AQ sites. So that does support your analysis. We are at 2:31, but we have one more question in the queue. Do you have time to take that?
Yes, certainly.
All right. Please go ahead, Bonnie. Introduce him.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll take our next caller. And please introduce yourself, if you wish, when your line is unmuted.
This is David Kudish from Aspen, Colorado. What about the purported three Israeli submarines in the Persian Gulf at all times? Conventional subs made by Germany with nuclear-tipped missiles. Are they still in that region?
Well, with regard to the precise mapping of Israeli naval activity, you know, the Navy doesn't send me its maps. I assume, however, I would assume, given the political situation, that they are in that neighborhood, and they are, of course, there to be used only at a moment of supreme need, which we thankfully are nowhere, as far as we can see, nowhere close to any time right now. If I may use the question to slightly broaden this issue with regard to Israel and Israel's part in all this, you know, Israel, of course, will be keeping its fingerprints very, very far away from anything happening on the ground in the Arabian Peninsula. But having said that, Israel is absolutely behind the stance which the Saudis are taking in this regard. That is to say, the hardline stance of trying to mobilize all possible assets in order to try to reduce or halt the Iranian advance across the region. Israel's very much on board with that. When it comes to, you know, clandestine assets, that's something which I guess is there but won't be visible and won't be overtly used in the immediate period, I would have thought.
Okay, we've reached the end of our time. Thank you, Mr. Kudish. And we'd like to thank the Middle East Forum. We'd like to thank Dr. Speier for his time and for the participants for calling in. This concludes our conference call.